Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is the Pony Express.
And coming to you from the Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans Studio. Rocket Mortgage with you every step of the way to provide a seamless experience coast to coast up and down North America. It is the Pony Express. Pony with an I. That's because my last name is Filippone, 10 letters. Very Italian-sounding last name. And happy to be with you today. What is supposed to be a dead period for the NFL? OTAs aren't really a fan-friendly thing. It's not like training camp where you show up for free on these college campuses or at these big training facilities and get autographs and watch teams prepare for the regular season. It's football in shorts is what it is. And the controversies that come out of this are guys who don't show up for voluntary workouts, even though they have big contracts, and some guys skip it, choose to work out on their own. Others show up. Tom Brady does his own thing, but that's kind of understandable or at least excused because he's the consummate winner. You don't second guess what he's doing. Whereas with Odell Beckham Jr. or Le'Veon Bell, these guys change teams, they get paid, and yet they're nowhere to be found, and it leads to coach-player conflict. In the Jets case, coach-GM conflict, where one guy gets shown the door. And that's really what constitutes NFL news in May. We're done with free agency, in June now. The draft is behind us. Free agency is pretty much over and done with. And we're just kind of waiting for anything that comes close to real football. And that'll be training camp and before you know it, the preseason. So to start summer, it's kind of a slow time for football. But I think what's cool about this time of year is it does lend itself to creative or outside-the-box football conversations where reporters who I think are smart will capitalize on this time of year and come out with a story that might take a more macro look at football and what the NFL's thinking, where it's headed, what's down the road. You know, when you're in the season, it's such a grind. There's so much drudgery. You know, you've got the games on Sunday, the injury reports in between, little soap opera, reality TV shows, stuff that pops up in between, coaches calling out players, quarterbacks upset, teams that underachieve, guys that get into trouble. I mean, from Labor Day through Valentine's Day, the NFL is the biggest story pretty much every day of the year. So I think good, really thoughtful, creative football reporters can find stories that might take more time, but often produce, I think, a storyline or create any story that, you know, otherwise you wouldn't have the time or the energy to work on. And I think I found one of those in the Washington Post. Mark Maskey, one of their reporters, on what might be some of the issues that pop up when the CBA runs out in 2021. And this was not an apocalyptic doomsday article about, well, folks, get ready for another lockout or strike between the players and the owners. There was a little bit of that. But mostly it was about, okay, here are the arguments that both sides are going to bring to the table. And there's going to be some trade-offs, and there are going to be some compromises. And what are the players going to agree to? What are they going to sign off on? And what concessions are they going to make to owners in order to have both sides coming away from the deal at least content or satisfied with what occurred. It doesn't sound like the players are going to get everything. They won't, because the owners have more money, and if they want to lock out the players, they'll cave in or give in before the owners do. That's how it works for the most part in professional sports. But the players will probably get some things, like a new marijuana policy. So what are the owners going to get back? And this article in the Washington Post brought up, I think, two ideas that have been on the table before that we've heard about that seem like they're either fantasies or far-fetched that might actually happen in the next couple of years. And it's about expansion, not adding teams, not going from 32 to, say, 34, not about expansion into Europe like a team in London or a franchise in Germany or Mexico City even, going international. It's about adding games, adding inventory, being able to get more games to sell to the television networks. You give them more, they'll pay you more. Everybody makes more money that way. But players balk at that because it's their hard work, it's their lives, it's their well-being that gets compromised. They've got to actually deal with the consequences of playing more. And so this has been a sticking point for players. That's why the 18-game season seems to be one of the issues that NFL players won't cave in on. That you would have to sweeten the pot in such an incredible way to even get them to consider that. Now, as a viewer, as somebody that just watches football and doesn't have any skin in the game as a player, I'd want more games. Why wouldn't you? I'd rather in August watch NFL games that mattered. I'd rather have 18 regular season games and fewer preseason games than have an entire month of exhibition football games that are barely watchable. How many games in the NFL preseason are good? Every team plays four. Maybe like one quarter or one half of the third game, which is the closest thing to a tune-up, dry run before the games. And a lot of teams like the Rams and the Packers don't even do that anymore. They won't play Aaron Rodgers one snap in Green Bay. I don't think Sean McVay played any of his guys in L.A. last year. So, you know, the preseason keeps getting worse. Fans get bamboozled and tricked into having to pay full price for those games as part of a season ticket package. They're boring as all get out. They're not entertaining. In the stadium, show it. You see an NFL preseason game, there's barely anybody there. So in a perfect world, you'd want to play more NFL regular season games and fewer preseason games. The problem is, can guys withstand that kind of punishment to play an extra two games? They probably don't want to do that. I can't blame them for it. Even if you worked in an extra bye week, I still don't think NFL players would go for it. So that's probably what the NFL owners want most. That would be if they had their druthers, plan A. But I actually like plan B better. Andrew Filippone, CBS Sports Radio, The Pony Express. You can follow me on Twitter at The Pony Express, Pony spelled P-O-N-I. I actually like the other idea that gets thrown out there and put out there in this Washington Post article. And the premise is, instead of adding to the regular season, add two more playoff games. Add two games. Not 16 to 18. Add two more playoff games. Go from 12 to 14 playoff teams. And I was so happy to read this because this is an idea, this is a belief that I have had for a long time. We like confirmation bias. I like to read things when I have what I think is a novel or original idea. And then I find out that somebody who has someone in positions of power, someone who can actually evoke change, when I hear that those people share the same thoughts, I get excited. You know, there's a politician that has the same agenda or the same beliefs as you, and they can push through a bill or they can push through legislation that, as a citizen, that would excite you. Somebody that shares your beliefs, shares your goals, shares your outlook on life. And that's what I see in this article. And I really have long subscribed to the idea that it makes a lot more sense for the NFL to have 14 playoff teams instead of 12. And let me tell you why I feel so strongly about this. I know maybe you think it's a weird thing to have a strong opinion on, but for me, I really do care about this. And I care about it because I believe what it does, if you add two playoff teams, so each conference has seven teams that make the playoffs, and you say, well, why would you, an odd number, that doesn't make any sense. It actually does from this perspective. I've never understood why we give the second best team the same benefit or the same advantage as the best team. So we play all year in the NFL last season, all right? And other than home field for the championship game, the Chiefs and the Patriots get the same benefit, right? So Kansas City wins 13 games and the Patriots win 11 and they both get byes. And for the life of me, I've never understood that. I don't get why we're rewarding second place as much as first place. If you go with seven teams in each conference making the playoffs, the only team that would get a week of rest would be your number one team in each conference. And to me, that separates, that gives the regular season winner the greatest reward. You know, hockey has the President's Trophy, which does nothing for the regular season champion. Baseball almost does its regular season champion no favors other than the fact that there's a one-off wild card game and that team, in theory, would use its best pitcher in the wild card game and start the division series with their number two guy on the mound, which is a slight advantage. In this case, give the team that finishes above everybody else in both conference the biggest advantage, and that is the two-game journey to the Super Bowl instead of the long way, which for the wild card teams now has always been three. So change that, and if you put seven teams in the playoffs from both conferences, like take last year, for example, because I've heard this argument before. Well, it waters down the playoffs too much. There aren't enough good teams to go around. If you add two more teams, you're just throwing mediocrity a bone. Well, last year, okay? Look, let's just use last year. If you expanded the playoffs to seven teams in every conference, the first week, the wild card weekend, two teams would get in. From the NFC, the Vikings would be the seventh team at 8-7-1, still a team with a winning record. Teams with winning records, seven lost teams have gone to the Super Bowl. The Cardinals with Kurt Warner, that was a seven-loss team. So you've got the Vikings would have played at the Rams wild card weekend, which is a pretty good matchup, I think. In the AFC, the wild card weekend 2-7 matchup would have been the Steelers at the Patriots. The Steelers went 9-6-1. In week 15, they beat New England. In week 16, they lost a nail biter to the Saints at the Superdome. Now, think about it also from the fan perspective, okay? Wild card weekend, which to this point, I think is just kind of a generic version of the next weekend, divisional weekend, where there are four games, but there are four better teams. And you've had to wait a week to watch two of the better teams in the NFL. You've had to wait to watch the four teams that got byes. If you expanded it out to seven teams in each conference, you'd have three games Saturday of Wild Card Weekend, three games Sunday of Wild Card Weekend. You'd have a 1 o'clock Eastern kickoff, a 4:25 Eastern kickoff, and then an 8:25 Eastern kickoff on Saturday and Sunday. Those 2 days would look like your typical NFL weekend, where the majority of us who don't have, you know, Red Zone Channel or the package, you'd get three games. And now you've got a more robust, football-filled weekend to start the playoffs. And the wild card weekend would look different from the divisional weekend. There'd be more games. The second-place team in each conference now would not have the same advantage as the number one team in each conference. And if you go back, I did this, you go back through history, the first team that missed the playoffs in each conference is almost always a team with 9 or 10 wins. And those teams are capable of winning at least one game in the playoffs. And in some cases, we have seen 9-win and 10-win teams go all the way to the Super Bowl. And in rare cases, we've seen those teams win. So that's the compromise I think that should happen. That's the one I'm rooting for. That the NFL, between now and 2021, when they get back to the negotiating table with the players, will open up the playoffs from 12 teams to 14 teams. And two extra playoff games, the networks will go crazy to air those games. It'll drive up the price. And I think it'll make everybody happy. And the players won't feel like the NFL is taking advantage of them and is speaking out of both sides of their mouth, meaning, how do you talk about how safety is so important and then ask us to play 18 games instead of 16? So I think that's the best move. Expand the playoffs by two teams, one in each conference. Andrew Filippone, CBS Sports Radio. If you got a thought on that, I'd love to hear it. 855-212-4CBS. That's 855-212-4227. Story in the Associated Press today about Major League Baseball attendance being down again. What's the matter there? What's the problem? Why are the reasons why Major League Baseball is losing fans coming through the gates, the turnstiles, year after year? I have a theory on that that I'll share with you. Love to hear from you on this NFL topic. 18 games, expanded playoffs. Are you for or against any of those ideas? 855-212-4227. I'm Andrew Filippone. It's the Pony Express on CBS Sports Radio.
This is the Pony Express.
And our toll-free number is 855-212-4227. It's brought to you by GEICO. Great news. Quick way you could save money. Switch to GEICO. Go to geico.com and in 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Story in the Associated Press by Ronald Bloom on baseball attendance being down again. This would be the fourth straight year the sport has seen its in-person viewership drop, that the league, through the first 2 months of the season, has seen fans in kind of smaller market cities. Teams have just hemorrhaged fans in some of those places. In fact, it's so bad in Miami, the Marlins' average attendance is less than a Triple-A team so far this year. Two-thirds of the league have seen their averages fall from a similar point last year. A few teams have seen big jumps. The Phillies, more than 10,000 fans per game, but remember, they signed Bryce Harper this offseason. Other teams that have made gains, Oakland, San Diego, and the White Sox. In the case of Oakland and the White Sox, you know, they couldn't really drop much more, and both teams are better. The A's made the wild card game last year, so some momentum from last season. The White Sox are in a rebuilding mode, but a lot of those guys are finally getting to the big leagues. San Diego's up because they signed Manny Machado. Now, in this article, it says Rob Manfred doesn't look at this as a sign that baseball is in declining health, because the cable ratings are so good, the TV ratings are great, and streaming numbers. The MLB.TV app is amazing. It's been like on, I think, the cutting edge of being able to allow people outside of a market, let's say, if you're a fan of the Red Sox, but you live in like Idaho, it's given you a chance to watch your team from afar. I think they were the pioneers of allowing you to watch games online or on apps. And that technology continues to be, I think, a big advantage for baseball. And so those numbers are good. They've got to figure out a way to get people to games. And it's not, you know, with baseball and with professional sports in general now, what you do at the gate is not going to make a big difference. At the end of the day, a team is not going to have its viability or its financial success based on fan attendance. There are so many things now, the television deals, the digital deals, the merchandising deals come before what people spend at games. It's a smaller piece of the pie than it was in the past. So I think what Major League Baseball needs to figure out here is they've got to incentivize, they've got to come up with ways to get people to go to see the game in person. And, you know, having a fireworks night or a bobblehead night, I think is a very antiquated way of trying to get people to games. If it's not, and this has been proven, if a team's financial records, if their books are not going to hinge on whether they average 25,000 people a game versus 20,000, if that's not going to make the difference at the end of the day, then make it more affordable for people to go to games. And I get some of these markets that I'm talking about, you can get into games for pretty much nothing. You go on these secondary ticket sites and you see all kinds of tickets available for games. The supply and demand, it is still absolutely a buyer's market. But you've got to create impressions and reasons for people to go. And this has been a belief, I think, in some circles, people that study professional sports, where professional sports are headed in America, have said that it makes sense for the places where these games are played to continue to make stadiums smaller and arenas smaller, to almost create a situation where it's like going to a show, there's a more intimate atmosphere at a game, the fewer the people, in theory, the more sold out it looks, the demand goes up, the louder a stadium can get, and that bleeds through and even makes it more enjoyable to watch on television when you see that kind of scene. So I think some of these places are too big, but in the meantime, you know, I would strive, and look, I don't have the answers on everything, but they've got to, and especially in baseball's case, they have to find a way to encourage young people to support the sport. And so if you're a place like Miami, and you're averaging fewer than 10,000 fans a game, and your ballpark seats or fits more than 35,000, why are you not, you should be giving thousands of tickets away to youth groups in Southern Florida. And hey, maybe that brings down, maybe that offends the season ticket holder a little bit. It devalues the ticket price or ticket value somewhat. But at least if you are in Marlins ownership, let's say, strategically you could be thinking, if we get young people to our games now, maybe they'll get the bug. Maybe they'll become interested in the sport. In 15 years from now, they'll be willing to spend money with us. That's, I don't think it benefits anybody to just have a 35,000 seat stadium with 6,000 people there. And so get younger people. Baseball's average fan is 57 years old right now. Studies show that. It is the sport for your grandfather and grandmother more than it is your son or daughter. And that's what they should do. And maybe that won't work, but it beats status quo. It would beat the belief that the television ratings and streaming ratings are so strong that baseball shouldn't concern itself whatsoever with how the ballparks look. It also, I think, on TV creates kind of a sterile, apathetic setting for these games. And I think that contributes to it being even harder to watch baseball on TV today than it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago when more people were going to games. Games didn't take as long, too. That's another problem. This is more proof to me that baseball needs to speed up its product. And if that means pitch clocks, which I have been a long opponent of because I think it kind of tears the fabric of the game, screw it. I've reached a point now where you can't have nine-inning games, 3-2 games that take 3.5 hours. Attention spans are short. People got other things to do with their time. And sitting there and watching guys readjust their batting gloves and their cleats and take 2 or 3 practice swings and pitchers walk around the mound and talk to position players and go to the rosin bag and take deep breaths. No one wants to watch that. I mean, if it's Game 7 of the World Series and you're in every pitch is do or die, that's way different than a game in early June. So baseball's got some problems, and to hear their commissioner say in this AP article that things are just fine, I think it's a delusional take. All right, coming up next, speaking of maybe delusionary beliefs or thoughts and fantasy, the overreaction to Game 1 of the NBA Finals is what we're going to talk about next. Are you starting to second-guess the Warriors? 855-212-4CBS. That's 855-212-4227. My name's Andrew Filippone. You can follow me on Twitter at the Pony Express. Pony spelled P-O-N-I. You can follow us on Twitter at CBS Sports Radio.
This is the Pony Express.
That was the star of Game 1, Pascal Siakam. 14 of 17, 8 rebounds, did most of the damage against Draymond Green. 32 points. Siakam and Mark Gasol had outstanding games for the Raptors. And it is easier to get those kind of secondary nights, secondary scoring performances, I believe, at home than it is on the road. And Game 2 is in Toronto. But I would bet good money, and I will. I'll put my money where my mouth is tonight. I live in a state, Pennsylvania, allows for sports betting. I will bet on Siakam to score fewer than 20 points tonight. Because he's a 16-point-per-game scorer. And if you look at his big scoring performances in the playoffs, he has three games of 25 points or more. When that happens, he comes back down to earth the next time out. Had a 25-point game, scored seven the next game. With these types of players, good players, not great players, you see more ebbs and flows, more peaks and valleys. And it was a 10-point game was the final. It was we're talking about a 3-4 possession game. If Siakam goes from 32 to 16, the Warriors will win. And I don't think you need to make the game more complicated than that. That they could get identical production from everybody. I don't think it's asking too much of Steph Curry to repeat what he did in Game 1. In every game Kevin Durant has missed in these playoffs, Curry has scored more than 30 points. So I think they could get 21 again from Klay Thompson, a pretty quiet, desultory type game from Thompson. And if they just do a better job on Siakam, they'll win. And who am I going to bet on in a situation like this? Am I going to bet on Pascal Siakam, who kind of is a one-hit wonder in his finals debut? Am I going to bet on him to do it again, to offer up an encore? Or am I going to bet on Draymond Green to do a better job defensively? They have not seen Toronto much. They now know what they're up against. They had 2 days to prepare for this. They're battle-tested. They're championship players. The Raptors will not have the same intensity, the same energy in the building tonight as in Game 1. They won't see that again in these playoffs unless they get to an elimination game at home where they're in the driver's seat. Like, if they came back for some reason, as crazy as this sounds, if they came back from Golden State up 3-1, Game 5 in Toronto would look like a madhouse. I'd probably pick them to win that game. I think that little edge or that little oomph that the Raptors got from Game 1, I don't expect them to get it in Game 2, because now Golden State has shaked off the rust. If there was any complacency, if they were stagnant at all, I think they sorted through that the first game. Jordan Bell started and played 11 minutes. I would expect Cousins to eat into more of that playing time. I think he's ready to give the Warriors more production than he did in Game 1. And Iguodala is going to play. Now, if he's out, then I'm giving you a different spin on Game 2. I'd give the Raptors a better chance. It's interesting, Andrew Filippone, CBS Sports Radio, that Vegas still has the Raptors favored. I tend to agree with the bookmakers, the odds makers. They're right more than they're wrong. They have a tendency to get the spread right more than we do as amateur prediction makers or prognosticators. You know, it's their livelihood. It's where their bread is buttered. It's how their money gets made. They can't They can't get these lines wrong. If they do, they go out of business. People lose their jobs over it. The Raptors are a 2-point favorite tonight. But yet, the Warriors are still favored. If you want to bet, and you can do this, you want to bet on series winner, Golden State is still favored to win the series. You have to pay a price to take Golden State to win the series. Vegas is telling you that they believe the Warriors are better with Durant than without. Now, I disagree with that. But they're telling you with this line, Vegas thinks that the Warriors will go down 0-2. They'll win the games in Golden State. And by the time the series comes back around to Toronto, they'll have Durant in the lineup for Game 4. They'll have him in the lineup for Game 5. They'll win Game 5 in Toronto, and they'll win Game 6 in Golden State. That's what Vegas thinks is going to happen. That when Durant comes back, the Warriors go from an underdog in Toronto to a favorite there. So if the line tonight is 2 without Durant, they get him back for Game 5. Maybe the line for that game in Toronto would be like Warriors by 2 or Warriors by 3. How often do we see the Warriors as an underdog? They've never gone down 0-2 in a series. They've gone down 3-1. We haven't seen them go down 0-2. And so I think the pressure is on Steve Kerr and company to come up with some kind of adjustment, and I trust that they will. And the other problem for Toronto, and I don't think this is getting as much publicity or coverage or a conversation as it deserves, Kawhi Leonard is hurt. And I think a big reason why we saw him struggle from the field 5 of 14 in Game 1 is because the knee tendonitis, the stress and fatigue of playoff basketball, has taken its toll on him. And I watched, hey, you can say what you want about Kyle Lowry and Mark Gasol and Pascal Siakam. They all play second fiddle to Kawhi Leonard. Those guys are not in their own right. They're not superstar players. They're not cut from the same cloth. It's not a situation where you think to yourself, especially at this point in Gasol's career, maybe a few years ago with him, but if we put these guys on another team, they could be the alpha male, they could be the top dog. It's not the case. Those are all role players, secondary players. If Kawhi Leonard isn't 100%, there's no way the Raptors are going to win this series. It's going to take a Herculean effort for them to beat Golden State and end this run. And physically, if he's not up to the task, they're going to get crushed. And that's why I think Golden State is a great bet tonight. If you remember last year in the playoffs, when LeBron was healthy, Game 1 of the NBA Finals was a fair fight. In fact, Cleveland had the Game 1. They should have won the game, if not for one of the all-time blunders in sports history, let alone basketball history, what J.R. Smith did in that game. We might live another 50 years and never see anything like that again in our lifetime. Somebody who had such a lack of awareness, such a low basketball IQ situation where there's just no comprehension of time and score. And that's why the Cavaliers lost that game. LeBron, out of frustration, breaks his hand, and he was a totally different player. And from there, any chance, any remote shot the Cavaliers had of winning that game went by the wayside. And so if we've got Kawhi Leonard at what? Like, let's say 60%? Maybe 70%? The Raptors aren't going to win this series. And they had pretty much everything go right for them in Game 1. Kawhi played her, and everything else around them went right. Gasol chipped in. Siakam chipped in. Van Fleet chipped in. Their bench was better than Golden State's. It was, other than Steph Curry's shooting performance, it was a Murphy's Law game for Golden State. They didn't have many breaks. They didn't have a lot of things go right. The 50-50 plays in the game, a ridiculous amount of them went to Golden State. So if you're somebody like me who believes in percentages, It's not going to be that case again tonight. So I would be really surprised if the series, I'm not shocked. I thought if Toronto was going to win a game at home, it was going to be game one. I'm not surprised that Golden State is trailing in this series. I will be if they go back to Golden State down 0-2. And even then, if it happens, I don't think it's the death knell, not by a long shot, for the Warriors. Like, very rarely would I say that the lion's share of the pressure is on the back of the team that won game one. But I think in this case it is. There's more pressure on Toronto to win this game than Golden State. If Toronto wins, it continues to it will now push the narrative that the Warriors have to get Golden, that they have to get Durant back. Maybe a little bit of doubt would creep into their mind. Now Durant, he might rush himself back. He might play at less than 100%. It throws Golden State off. You know, maybe they throw a game away. They're not invincible at home anymore. We watched them lose to the Clippers, for crying out loud. You know, and that might complicate matters for Golden State. But if it goes back 1-1, there's no rush for Durant to come back from injury. And if it's 1-1, the Warriors and their faithful are probably thinking they'll send the series back to Toronto up 3-1. So Toronto needs to win the game. I don't think they will. My belief is the headline for game two will be Kawhi's not right. We'll see Draymond shut down Siakam. And I think Monday morning, Boogie Cousins is going to get, unless the media, which seems like it's kind of out to get him because some of the things they've said about him before. If the media, if the basketball media and sports media is going to be honest with itself, I think the glue guy or the kind of MVP, low-key MVP of this game tonight will be Boogie Cousins. That he'll make his presence known in this series and he'll make his decision to sign with Golden State. It'll make sense by the end of the night when he does something that helps to either a stop, a block shot, a big three, a microwave moment off the bench where he scores maybe 6 or 7 points in a 3 or 4 minute stretch when guys are resting, with the starters are out. I think he puts his fingerprints on this game tonight. So I'm taking Golden State. Usually that's not going out on a limb, but they are a 2-point underdog. All right, thanks to everybody in New York. On many of these same stations, the great Jody McDonald is next. I'll talk to you next week on the Pony Express.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.